We'll start our interview today by having you tell us your name.
I'm Lawrence L. Kuntz, Jr.
And when and where were you born, Justice Kuntz?
I was born on January 25th, 1940 in Roanoke, Virginia. Sounds like 100 years ago, doesn't it?
Not too long ago. Tell me a little bit about your parents and if you have any siblings.
My parents, my father was an electrical engineer. My mother was an art teacher who retired when my oldest sister was born. I have two older sisters, and then I'm the baby of the family. So I was pretty much spoiled as I came along.
How did your parents meet? Were they both from the Roanoke area?
They were, they had a blind date in Fishersville, Virginia. And I'm not sure exactly how that came about, but my mother came with her older sister up there to see something on a farm, and my father was there.
And tell me about growing up in the Roanoke Valley.
Well, when I grew up, it was the best of times. We didn't have, you know, what you read about in the newspapers and in the press all the time. I grew up across from a city park, and there were always games every season. If it was football season, there were a dozen or more of us ready to play on any day and so forth. So it was that part of growing up in Roanoke was just an absolute carefree time. But I think some of my favorite times when I was a youngster was we had a family farm in Luray, Virginia. And my uncle was a bachelor, and he ran the farm for his siblings. So I spent a lot of summers down there with him, and I just loved being on the farm and being around all the activity that was going on there.
So you did things like drove the tractor and helped tend a garden.
I did.
Fishing and maybe a little hunting.
We had... the farm was a breeding farm for cattle, but we raised a lot of crops, corn, hay, and that kind of stuff. So one of my great thrills was to bring the bales of hay out of the field into the barnyard and stack them up. And I just thought, you know, I really thought I was something doing that.
And you attended public schools in Roanoke?
All the way through the public schools in Roanoke. I finished at what was then Jefferson High School. It's now sort of a museum place. It's not no longer a high school. And then I went from there to Virginia Tech. And remarkably, I got my degree in biology. And I went from there to law school.
Now, why the decision to go to Virginia Tech? You mentioned your father was an engineer. Had he gone to Tech?
My father, my brother-in-law, several uncles, everyone in the family had gone to Tech. I had been admitted to Hampton, Sydney, where my buddies were going. And my dear mother, bless her heart, she said, "You can go anywhere you want to, but you'll break your father's heart if you don't go to Tech." So off to Tech I went.
But that wasn't a bad choice, was it?
No, it wasn't a bad choice for me, not at all. At that time, it was all military, it was all Corps. There were no women on the campus. And so that didn't suit my personality too much. I wasn't too big on the rigors of military. And it just so happened that I was elected as the defense attorney for the Honor Court, which was a very formal process they had in those days. And the benefit I got from it originally was my room was exempt. Even the commandant couldn't come in and inspect. So I was able to have coffee pots and a lot of things that you couldn't really have in there. And it was through that process that over a two-year period, I decided that I really liked at least what my concept at that time of law was, and that's what made me change.
So that really prompted the decision then to go to law school or investigate
Absolutely.
That as a career.
Absolutely.
And why T.C. Williams in Richmond?
Well, I was admitted to several law schools. I chose Richmond. I'm sorry to say for the school's benefit, but it's where my wife had a job teaching school, so that made a lot of difference in where we went.
Well, you mentioned Ms. Smith. Tell us about meeting your wife, Eberly L. Smith.
Well, it was a different wife at that time.
Oh, a different wife.
That my first wife is deceased, but my Eberly, who I've been married to for 37 years, she worked for the juvenile court, and gosh, we were friends, I guess, for 6 years or more before we ever realized that we were attracted to each other. But it was through work that I met.
Through work? Well, you mentioned your first wife. How did you meet your first wife? Was she from Roanoke, or did you meet her while you were?
Yes, I had known her growing up.
Growing up. You went to school with her?
Right.
And you and your first wife had children?
We had three. We had a son and two daughters.
And I understand you also have some grandchildren?
I have seven.
Seven.
Don't ask me their names, because surely I'll miss one of them. But
well, wait, more boys or more girls?
Almost all boys except for two girls.
After graduating from T.C. Williams School of Law at the University of Richmond, you returned to Roanoke. So you kind of went back home, and you worked at the firm of Eggleston, Holton, Butler, and Glenn. What kind of practice did you have at the firm?
It was a very general practice. I did some real estate work. I did some wills. I did some criminal defense work. I did some divorce work. It was a very, very general practice.
Did you, in law school, of course that was the academic environment, did you do certain kind of trial courses that helped you prepare for that?
You know, we really didn't have trial courses back in those old days. So my education at that time was, there again, very general. I mean, I took everything from contract law to, God forbid, income tax law. And so it was not a particular training for a particular kind of practice.
Are there particular professors that you remember from that time?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Can you tell us about some of your memories of law
school?
One
of my favorite professors was Mr. Barnett. And he taught a number of courses, but you also got to study under him his first year. And he was a deep sort of thinker. And he would reason around one way, and then he'd reason around the other way. And it was very frustrating for people who didn't pick up quickly on what he was doing. And so what I did, I took copious notes, and then after class I would go and figure out what it was he was trying to say. We had a practice exam, and give you sort of a flavor for Mr. Barnett. The first year you had literally a practice exam, so you'd have some idea of how you were doing. And one of my classmates, he gave you a case and you had to discuss it and decide. And one of my classmates wrote about two paragraph answer. And the answer was absolutely correct. But the professor gave him a very low marks for it. And he said, well, Mr. Jones, you know, I take a lot of time preparing my questions, and I expect you to take a lot of time answering them. So that was sort of, but he was a fascinating guy.
Fascinating. That's good. So you returned to Roanoke, and you began, and you practiced in this law firm, and you did a general practice. But not long after that, you moved over to the Commonwealth Attorney's Office.
Right.
How did that come about?
Well, it was sort of strange. I knew the Commonwealth Attorney very well and thought a lot of him. And I wanted to try more cases than I was trying. So he persuaded me that if I came to his office, I would try cases almost every day, which is literally what we did. And because I had made up my mind at that time I wanted to be a trial lawyer. So I went there to get the trial experience.
And any remarkable cases you remember, or cases that you found difficult, because that was so different than what you had been doing in the law firm?
Well, I don't know that I would say there was any one, particularly one that was difficult. When you first start off, you think all of them are difficult. And then in a matter of time, they become pretty routine. But I tried a murder case one time that was very frustrating to me. And this man had been shot on a public street, shot several times, once in the body, once in the shoulder, once through the heart. And so the police investigator had gone out, and we had 6 eyewitnesses. And so we went to trial, and we got in front of the jury, and naive me, I called the first witness, and he didn't know anything what I was talking about. I said, well, you were there, weren't you? He said, well, I guess I was, but I don't remember what happened. And that was the same, we went through all of that with every witness.
And you heard the same story with each one.
And so that taught me the lesson that people come to court, they don't always say what they've said before. But they were afraid. They were afraid to testify.
So but they were afraid of the repercussions that someone might then...
I just didn't realize that.
Well, that was a lesson that you didn't forget,
right.
I'm sure. And then even shortly after that, so you've been at the law firm and you've moved to the Commonwealth Attorney's Office where you're an assistant Commonwealth Attorney and you're trying cases. In 1967, you were appointed to serve as a judge in the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court, General District Court in Salem, where you served for 9 years. In retrospect, this appears to be a turning point in your life. Tell us about those first days sitting on the bench.
Well, when I went to the juvenile court, I wasn't sure that's career-wise what I should do. And I talked to some of the older members of the bar and asked them what they thought, because prior to my going on that court, we had had some difficulties. Judges had really come under strain that they couldn't handle. And so I said, well, I don't want that to happen to me. And one of the lawyers that I admired so much said, well, if you want to be a trial lawyer and you'll get back into private practice, it's a whole lot better to be a former judge of anything than an assistant Commonwealth attorney. So I said, well, I will do it for 2 years. That was my plan. And once I got into it, and I really thought the court could do a lot of good for a lot of people, and I just sort of got caught up in that. And being as young as I was, it didn't have any immediate toll on me, so I just thoroughly enjoyed it.
You thoroughly enjoyed it. I don't know, I know now they have orientation sessions for new judges. Did they do that then?
No, they didn't. They swore you in, showed you where the courtroom was. But you asked me about my first day. I will never forget. I was trying a case and there was a more established lawyer in the community than certainly I was. And he was arguing a point of law, which I just didn't agree with. And just for a few seconds, I thought to myself, well, he's probably right. He's been around longer than I have. Why should I trust my own feelings about it? But I did. And from that day on, I just said, well, lawyers can argue in front of you, and they try to help you make the right decision, but ultimately it falls on you. And so that's,
you as judge,
I learned that from day one.
Yeah. Make the final decision. Were there certain kinds of cases that were harder than others, in terms of harder, just to, to deal with personally?
There's no question in my mind that the termination of parental rights cases were the most difficult. In a way, you know, not every parent is perfect. And there's a gray line between being, well, not such a good parent and being one that should have no parental rights. And few of those cases would it be a clear situation. And you're trying to tell yourself, what gives the best hope for this child's future versus the natural rights of the parent? So I always found them very, very difficult.
Is there one thing you might have changed about the way Virginia's juvenile and domestic relations courts handled cases then, if you could go back and maybe
Well, if there's more than one thing, maybe. How much time do you have? We had, across the state, the juvenile court, of course, was held in private, and so it was sort of like out of sight, out of mind, in terms of what the court needed to do its job correctly. And I'll give you a perfect example of that. I'd gone through a series of cases which involved the psychological difficulties particular children were having. And I was actually just left with no expert. I mean, I had to sort of decide based on what they were saying, does this child have a problem or not? And I went to a meeting in Northern Virginia, and I'll never forget it. The Arlington Juvenile Court was a whole lot more sophisticated than we were in the Roanoke Valley in those days. And they had a staff psychologist. And I remember asking the judge, what in the world is that? And he said, you mean you don't have one? And I said, no, as a matter of fact, I don't, but I can tell you when I get back, I'm going to start down that road to getting one. The point of all that is the juvenile courts in those days were poorly staffed with people with expertise. Today, that's not necessarily the case, but there was a whole lot of shooting in the dark back in those days.
And I'd also read in preparation that you were instrumental in getting the Juvenile Domestic Relations Court into a new building, that the building you were originally working out of was in pretty bad shape.
Well, it's maybe why I took the job over all the other people who were considered, because nobody particularly wanted to work in the courthouse. The juvenile court at that time was a former detention facility. And they had living quarters for the house parents, I guess you'd call them, on the first floor. And then on the next floor up, they had literally detention cells. I mean, they had locked doors, and some of them had bars on them. And it was heated by a coal stoker furnace. And if you wore a white shirt in there from time to time, you'd get home and your cuffs would be all dingy from when in the wintertime, when it was sort of sooty. It was a rat trap. It was disgusting. So what I did is I had pictures, took pictures, and I went to the Roanoke Bar Association luncheon and as a speaker. And I just said, now here's what the children and families of our community get when they come to court. And so then they quickly started the movement, and we were able to move to a very nice facility down the street.
Were there judges more senior to you that you looked to for advice or mentoring?
Well, my mentor was my second father. At least he felt like a second father, who was the general district judge in Roanoke at that time. He had been my Sunday school teacher, and I just adored him, and he was always good to me. So I would go to him from time to time to talk about things in general. But I had practiced before him from the time I finished law school until I went on the juvenile court. Excuse me. And I was always impressed about how fair he seemed to be. He was very even-tempered, and so I sort of tried to be like him if I could. I'm not sure I was successful, but he was a big influence on me.
In 1976, you moved to the circuit court for the 23rd Judicial Circuit. So the cases changed, I guess, somewhat. Instead of juvenile and domestic relations cases in terms of the scope, you're hearing now both criminal and civil cases and a variety of cases?
Yes. Cases across the board. And that was the, to be frank with you, it allowed me to get out of a very, very trying and sad situation. It wasn't always sad. I thought if we helped children and their families from time to time, that was great. But it was just a continual flow of sad situations in people's family. When you went on the circuit court, it was not that case. It was sort of fun to watch two corporations fight each other and that kind of thing. So it was a change in the atmosphere for me, which I sort of thrived on. I loved it.
Well, you mentioned the change in the atmosphere because of the nature of the cases. Your service on the circuit court from 1976 to 1985 was also during a time of a lot of change just generally in society. The aftermath of the Vietnam War, increasing role of women in the workplace. From your seat on the bench, what sort of changes did you see reflected maybe in the cases you were having to handle?
Well, it was during that time that drugs became a problem, and you started seeing more and more drug cases. That's probably the most significant thing in the cases. But going back to what you said about the women, one of the other things that was dramatically noticeable is almost overnight we started having women lawyers. And when I first went on the juvenile court, there was one woman lawyer in the Roanoke Valley. And so then when I went on the circuit court, it seemed like every day there were more and more women lawyers, and they did a fine job. And it was just sort of nice to see that transition.
But there were no women at that time on the bench in the
Roanoke
Valley.
Oh, no.
Not quite then yet.
We had to crawl before we got to that.
By 1984, well, it was years in coming, the Court of Appeals of Virginia was created, started hearing cases in January of 1985, and you served on that court from January 1 of 1985 to August 15th of 1995. So a little over 10 years, almost 11 years. You were a charter member of this Virginia Court of Appeals. Tell us about the first meeting of this group of judges, which you discussed, and how you prepared for the very first term of court.
Well, we came together. There were 10 of us. Barbara Keenan, Judge Keenan, was the sole woman on the court. And we sort of knew each other professionally, but we didn't really know each other. So the first few meetings really involved sort of getting to know who it was we'd now been thrown together to organize and get this court running. But one would need to understand there were absolutely no rules for how the court was to operate. We knew what our jurisdiction was, but we didn't know how we were going to handle it. So we started working on what would be a good way to organize. And there were those on the court at that time that thought, well, maybe we should have regional panels, which would be more or less permanent. And so you could begin to see, or at least I thought, we'd have the law of Western Virginia, we'd have the law of Northern Virginia,
Tidewater.
So we'd have a lot of conflicting judgments. So that was one of the first big issues I think we correctly resolved, which was that we would literally rotate. You would sit on every regional panel. There were four regions. You would sit on each of those regions during the year. The side effect of that was we got to know each other a whole lot better, quicker, and I think became very good friends.
Well, it did force you almost to travel together.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Especially if you weren't in your home.
Exactly.
For the panel.
Exactly.
As well as the fact that you almost reverting back to the early days of Virginia's courts where judges traveled like that quite a bit to go where the cases were.
Yeah.
As opposed to having the litigants come to them.
Yeah, my wife, Everly, at the time, she used to think I had moved out of town because I was gone so much. But it did require coming to Richmond, coming to Northern Virginia, or coming to Norfolk a lot.
Unfortunately, about 3 months into the beginnings of that court, the then Chief Judge Baker passed away. And you became and you were elected among your peers to serve as the Chief Judge of the court. Were there adjustments moving from the role of being a person on the court to being now all of a sudden the chief judge and the administrative head of this new body?
Well, very definitely, but I would want to say that it's a shame for a lot of reasons that Judge Baker passed away. He was a gentle man that was quiet but very knowledgeable, and I would say he just reeked of respect. We all were very fond of him, so he was an easy person for us to pick as our first chief, and we were just floored when he passed away so quickly. But when the court asked me to take over as the chief judge, it was like writing on a clean blackboard. We had to get organized, and we had to get organized quickly. So it was different for me in that I was no longer able just to go and hear the cases and write my opinions. I had to be worried about everything else that was going on. And I'll give you a perfect example of that. What is now the clerk's office for the Court of Appeals, which is, as you know, right next to the facility here in this building. That was the Rose LaFoon building. And we were struggling, at least I was, to get our clerk's office separated from the Supreme Court. I thought we should have our own clerk's office for a lot of reasons. But so I worked, I guess, maybe a year and a half before I could persuade the powers to be to turn that building over to us. And
I'm curious, I was here at the time. Was that building even being used?
No. Okay. The state owned it. It had formerly been, I think, a real estate facility, but it was part of the state property. And but I would tell my wife, I've got to go to Richmond and work on this Rose LaFoon thing. So we were at a judicial conference right at the time that they finally agreed to let us have the building. And then Chief Justice Harry Carrico, it was at Virginia Beach. And I loved the man a lot, but I could have wrung his neck when we came into a reception he was having. And I very flippantly said, Chief Justice, I wish you'd tell Everly that Rose LaFoon really is a building down here. And he looked at my wife and said, wouldn't you think he could come up with a better story than that? He thought it was funny. I sort of thought it was funny, but Everly looked at it.
Oh, I bet Everly thought it was funny, too.
Yeah, in time, she did.
She probably thought it was funny, too. Yeah, so the Court of Appeals, your service there over a 10-year period of time, number of changes, I guess, over that period of time, people coming and going. As you look back, what are some of your, the things you remember about your those days on that court, because it is very different than your role was as an appellate judge on the Supreme Court of Virginia?
Well, the early days, I mean, we had to do such simple things like decide seniority and things like that, because the appellate courts rely on that concept pretty heavily. Well, we didn't have any seniors, so we went alphabetically, and we literally sat around the table alphabetically. We literally sat in the courtroom, depending on your last name, and we drew cases that way. So it was very important what your last name was in those days, because that depended on where you were and what you were going to have to write. But in a very short order, and I was always very proud of my colleagues, in a very short order, you could just see that they were dedicated, that the court was going to do its job and do it well. And I think they did. There were a lot of areas like the new equitable distribution statute that you could read the statute, but you weren't sure how it was going to be applicable in a particular case. And the court took the took those on and spent many, many opinions sort of defining the parameters of what the statute was all about. But it was that kind of thing that was, it was intellectually fun to do, but we also felt like it was important what we were doing.
Yeah, in many cases you were treading new ground in Virginia.
Absolutely.
Because there was there wasn't anything.
Absolutely.
In that area of law.
And it was very important for us to remember that the way the law was written, with the exception of criminal cases, the law was intended that in civil matters, administrative agencies and domestic relations, that the Court of Appeals would have the last say in those cases, unless and until the Supreme Court decided it was such an important matter that they would hear it. So we realized that the Supreme Court wasn't going to hear anything like as many cases as we were hearing. So we had to be very careful and very clear about what we did.
The Court of Appeals did and still does to this day have an incredible caseload. Tell us a little bit about the difference in the opinions. You mentioned these opinions that, that were being written, but the Court of Appeals, unlike the Supreme Court of Virginia, released both published opinions and unpublished opinions and memoranda decisions. What went into the idea that that's how you would handle the cases in terms of providing the resolution, that not everything would be published necessarily? Or
well, in very general terms, If a case involved an issue which was new or particularly significant, we always published those opinions. If the case really just involved something that was well established and the court, the lower court either done it right or done it wrong, there was no need just to keep adding that to the case law. So we would use unpublished opinions in those cases. I have personally always been a little concerned about unpublished opinions, whether they're in the Court of Appeals or in the Supreme Court, because you wonder if there's this sort of secret, which is not a good word, but unknown body of law that's floating around that may or may not exactly be the same as the published opinions. And I think the bench and the bar have had concerns about that, and I think rightfully so.
You were appointed to fill the vacancy created by the retirement of Justice Henry H. Whiting to the Supreme Court of Virginia in August of 1995. And this was the same seat on the Supreme Court of Virginia that you had actually vied for in 1987. Do all good things come to those who wait?
Well, I don't know, but it's funny because Justice Whiting got the nomination, as you say, when the two of us were in contention for it, and it never would have occurred to me that ultimately I would take his place. So I guess you could say I was trailing him for all those years, but I was always thankful that I got to serve with him, because even though we had been sort of in a contest years before, he was a remarkable man, very, very bright, and a good colleague. So I felt I learned a lot from him, too. So I don't know whether all things come around like that, but it did in my case.
Well, that also speaks, though, to the sort of the political nature of an appointment. I don't know that judges themselves necessarily are political, but the way the process is handled in Virginia by the legislature, even when one is appointed by the governor, you still have to be further, you know, elected or confirmed by the legislature. Do you recall people around you at the time, what they were saying, or in terms of were there legislators who were telling you, well, you're going to get another chance, you know, this might happen again?
Well, it would be almost dishonest for anybody to maintain, even today, that the initial appointment to these courts is not political, because it is. And I've always thought that was almost comical, because you read about the Democrats this and the Republicans that, about which candidate they want. And once they elect somebody, in the 17 years or whatever it was that I've been on the serving on the Supreme Court of Virginia, I never saw an instance ever in a case in which anybody knew, cared, or made any difference in what supposedly political label you had when you came in. I mean, it's just a myth, and rightfully so. But in answer to your question, yes. What happened to me was there was, at that instance, I was nominated by the House, which was controlled by the Democratic Party at that time, and another person was elected by the Senate. Now, I guess you'd say that we were both good Democrats. Neither of us were good enough or something, but because we got hung up between those two bodies. And it was then that the governor stepped in and appointed Justice White. So he was sort of the compromise between the two. But there was never any question, and I wouldn't want to say that you go from day to day saying, well, you know, when's my time coming, because you don't think about it until it comes up. But I never had any doubts that when the time came that I would probably serve on the Supreme Court.
During your tenure on the court, there have been a number of changes, increasing number of women serving on the state's high court, the first African-American Chief Justice, the first female Chief Justice. Have there been other changes you've noticed through the years?
Well, wasn't that fortunate for me? In terms of history, I've always just been excited about the thought that I was able to be there when we had our first African-American and our first woman Chief Justice. So that, to me, I've always thought, gosh, what a wonderful time to have been on the court. In terms of the changes, there have been some very definite changes. When I first came on the court, there were very few working spouses in the justice pool. So when you would have meetings and all, most dinners, most everybody would either have their husband or, well, in that time, husband or wife. And over the years, well, if you take the present court, most of them have working, successful career spouses, so you tend to end up having a lot of bachelor meetings because their spouses can't attend. So that has changed sort of the chemistry. Mm-hmm. Now, what I mean by that, at one time, the court did everything together. They would even walk down the street together, go into the cafeteria. as opposed to going their separate ways for lunch, that kind of thing. But in the conference room, in this particular room that we're in, you could sit and watch what I call the chemistry of the court changing. Now, I'm not saying that's good or bad, but I'm just saying it's a change. And when you have men and women discussing and deciding something, and you have all men, there is a different, I call it chemistry, of how the debate goes. I would assume it would be that way if they were all women. I just, I can't speak to that. But, and I think it's good. I think there's a whole lot more open debate than there used to be. I really do. And I'm just glad that I was around to watch all that happen.
To see it. I once noted to a justice, the increasing number of paper clips on opinion days is a reflection of the change. And he asked me, well, what are you talking about? And I said, well, the library used to receive a stack of the slip opinions on the Friday of opinion date. And in the early 80s, when I first worked here, there wouldn't be any paper clips. And it, as the years went by, you'd see a paper clip here and there. And then until the time that we no longer even got paper opinions because we received them electronically, there were lots of paper clips. As a matter of fact, there were probably more opinions that had paper clips than not. And to me, that was a visual clue that the number of dissenting opinions and concurring opinions was increasing, because the clip represented the fact that they had to be attached together in the stack. To what do you attribute this change?
Well, I go back to the one thing is the makeup of the court at the time you're originally referring to. The court was pretty much cut out of the same mold. And as I say, I don't mean that in a disrespectful or derogatory way. But the truth of it was they were pretty much all the same age. They were all pretty much had the same backgrounds. And so there was a feeling, I know when I first came on the court, there was a feeling that it had to be really, really significant for you not to go along with the majority. It was perceived as being a reflection on the court as not being unified and so forth. And I think the justices worked hard to avoid dissents and concurring opinions, and that was just a part of what they tried very hard to do. Now, over time, when the basic makeup of the court changed, it seemed to me anyway that there was less effort made to resolve those differences. In other words, it got to be almost, well, if you don't agree, then descend in your dissent. And I don't know whether that's good, bad, or indifferent, but in the sense that an individual justice feels comfortable dissenting, then I think that's great. I remember the first time I dissented, which I think was about a year and a half or so after I'd first come on the court. And I was as nervous as a cat on a hot tin roof, thinking, well, who am I to be disagreeing with the Supreme Court? And it involved a issue of whether a property owner had the right to control fishing in a public river. And I prepared that dissent because I felt pretty strongly about it. And then I was very timid about presenting it to the court. And then Justice Compton, who was much, much my senior on the court, came into my office before I turned it into the full court. He said, I want to join your dissent. And anyway, it just gave me, I felt so good that, well, it's not just me, so I felt better about it. But dissents and concurrences have their place. I wrote a dissent in a case that will always be important to me, which involved the imposition of the death sentence on a mentally retarded.
The Atkins case.
Yeah. And it, as you know, that went to the Supreme Court, and they, I don't say they agreed with my dissent, and then I think Chief Justice Hassell had also written a dissent in that case. But the Supreme Court agreed that it was a poor reflection on us as a society if you execute truly mentally handicapped person. So my point is, there are times when you feel like that you were glad that you didn't hold back, that you expressed yourself, because I have been told that it was part of the dissents in that case that caused the U.S. court to look at it. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but that's what I've been told.
So perhaps dissent's a healthy thing, a good way for that deliberation of whatever the rule of law is going to be on something, that is shared and not just something that happens in the conference room and doesn't go beyond.
Oh, absolutely, because I think one of the things over the years that I've seen, dissents have prompted the legislature to make a change on a particular point. And so I think that's very valuable.
During your long tenure on Virginia's courts, you've mentored and worked with a number of law clerks. Tell me about your relationship with your clerks over the years. The role they played and...
I've always had the feeling that I've been fortunate. I never had a law clerk that I didn't feel like I worked well with and that I didn't feel like was helpful to me. I would almost without exception, on the first day, I would tell my new clerk that I'm hiring your mind. I'm not hiring you to say I'm always right. So what I tried to do was create an atmosphere. I mean, I realized I had the final say, obviously, but it didn't help me for a clerk to sit there and let me go down the primrose path when they were sitting there saying, well, maybe you could look at this a different way. So I relied on them to sort of be my watchdog. And so we had very lively debates on various points of who was right and who was wrong. And of course, then ultimately I told them they were wrong and went on did what I was going to do, but not always.
And you've kept up with many of these clerks
yes.
through the years.
Yes.
And a number of your clerks who've had very successful law practices.
They're all doing well, yeah.
And doing well. You retired from the court at the end of January in 2011, and you're continuing as a senior justice on the Supreme Court of Virginia. But you also have a new gig. You're with the McCammon Group. I'm guessing you maybe enjoy the role you play as mediator. Is this correct?
Oh, I thoroughly enjoy it. Mediation for me is an opportunity for there to be no winners and no losers. A case that is, in my judgment, well mediated, both sides come away feeling that they've reached a resolution that they're basically happy with. And so I thoroughly enjoy that. I've spent too many years telling one side they win, the other side they lose. So this is, it's like a breath of fresh air for me, and I thoroughly enjoy it.
Well, the reason I said I thought this that you enjoyed this role, in an article I read in the Roanoke Times, it mentioned that you had earned a reputation as the chancellor during your tenure on the Supreme Court of Virginia. Can you share with me a little bit about that? Did you know you were called the chancellor?
No, I didn't know that. I guess, and I'm certainly not ashamed of it, and I'm not. It's not something I would walk around being particularly proud of, but I have always felt very, very strongly that a law ought to be fair in the result it reaches on individuals. And I think I've told people before, but that comes from an experience I had when I first went to Virginia Tech. Like I say, it was all core. And I'd been there about 3 months. And it was a cold winter night, 3 a.m. They came around the dorms and made us all get up and put our uniforms on. We went down to what we call the lower quad, which is basically an open area surrounded by four buildings. And the entire corps went there. And they brought this cadet in who was a sophomore. And it was raining, and I was sitting there, why are we doing this? And they came down, they being the seniors in charge, and they stripped this boy's uniform, any insignia that he had that would reflect he was from Virginia Tech. And then as he was escorted out of that area to a waiting cab, and as he walked past, each company in the Corps turned their backs on him. Mm. And of course you'd recognize that as the drumming out, which they no longer do. But from that day on, I thought, well, you know, and I worried about it. I don't know what he'd done, maybe cheated or something, but I've always thought, suppose they were wrong. I mean, suppose he didn't deserve that. The carrot, you might wonder, well, why would he do it if he wasn't guilty? The carrot was that if you went through that process, then your record was clean. You could go to any other school and not have to say that I was accused of this. So rather than run the risk of actually being convicted of the offense, they could choose that and avoid the possible penalty of their future being hampered. So over the years, I guess I have always been more concerned about the individual, real people that were involved in our cases. And it's always just been important to me.
So that's been your guiding kind of, at all levels of the court, juvenile domestic relations, the circuit court, the two appellate courts, in terms of what is the impact of this going to be on the individuals.
Mm-hmm. And those individuals are real people to me. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's just a party to a litigation. They're real people, and I've always been sensitive to that.
Are there any cases that you drafted while you were on the Supreme Court of Virginia that you particularly have not fond memories, that's the wrong way to term it, but that are memorable for you for one reason or another? You mentioned the Atkins case. You mentioned the case where you wrote your first dissent that you were concerned about.
Well, of course, you know, I guess all of our opinions are important to the litigants in the particular case. So I wouldn't want to say that some of them are important, some of them aren't. But I can tell you that the case that made me feel the best about the Supreme Court and the justices. And we had a case basically where a small child had fallen out a window, and the child had leaned against the screen in the window. The screen didn't hold the child, and the child fell out, and obviously was severely injured. And the suit was against the maker of the screen. And we heard the case, and we came back to this very room, and there was not a member sitting around this table who was not touched by this tragedy that had fallen on this little child. And even with her own children, you say, well, they're but the grace of God. You know, how many times have you had a child who's gotten up next to a window and could have fallen out? But the law was very clear that the manufacturer of that screen could not be liable because it was not made as a child protection device. And so around this table, the justices indicated how they were going to go, and they all went, without exception, in spite of their personal feelings. They said we have to uphold the law, and I wrote an opinion basically saying that. But I left this room thinking, what a great comfort it is to know that these people will do what is right, what the law requires, regardless of what they personally might feel. And so from that day on, I never ever questioned the sincerity of any justice's position, because I knew they were sincere about it.
Well, Justice Koontz, thank you so much for taking the time to share this interview with me today, and we appreciate it.
I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.